Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And in case you're wondering what on earth it means the lion is sleeping. The lion. The legend says the lion isn't dead. He's just sleeping. He'll wake up someday and lead us to freedom.
Hey folks, Paco here. On this episode of SupDoc, I recap the 2019 documentary, The Lion's Share, currently streaming on Netflix. As someone who has worked in the music business, I can say with ease that it is brutal. From royalties and demanding record labels to artists being sued for copyright infringement, it's sometimes difficult to remember a time when these things weren't the norm. The Lion Sleeps Tonight is one of the most recognizable songs in our history. Under the original title Mbube, written and recorded in 1939 by South African singer Solomon Linda. Through a combination of chicanery and misunderstanding, this international hit song is a complex tale of artist exploitation, though only in its circumstances make it out of the ordinary. The attempts to right this wrong are the subject of The Lion's Share, the latest episode of Netflix music documentary series Remastered. And my guest is comedian and musician Phil Johnson, who, because of his long hair, often gets mistaken for a woman, but only by those not paying attention. That revelation kicks off a battle for self-awareness where comedy and music are the weapons of choice. It's a battle that has taken Phil to such esteemed festivals as the Edinburgh Fringe and Sundance Film Festivals, and the top eight finals of the World Series of Comedy. And now, here's my talk with Phil. Okay, so, The Lion's Share. Fuck, dude. What a doc.
It's a crazy story.
It's a crazy story. Yeah. We might as well just start. I wasn't thinking okay. We're starting, but we might as well just start.
It's insane.
It's insane.
Yeah.
And it's... So, Phil Johnson's here.
I'm here.
Known Phil for a long time. Musician, comedian, funny fucking guy. Lots of respect for this man, because you've been doing it for a long...
15 years.
15
in
years.
In comedy, yeah.
In comedy. You've toured. You play everywhere. You're one of the few guys I ever knew that, like, knew how to leave... like the Bay Area and go do comedy.
I had to.
Yeah. That's yeah, of course. That makes sense. But did you always have a car?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've had a car since I was 17, pretty regular. I mean, I live in the suburbs, so
right. You
don't get to, you know, walk everywhere. And
did you buy a house?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we bought a house in 2005.
Oh wow.
Yeah, right at the top of the bubble. So it was good planning.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. And so you hit me up on Facebook and you're like, hey, have you seen this documentary? Which
yeah.
is one of my favorite things instead of like me like looking for ads and stuff. Like
sure.
I love when friends who know that I do a documentary podcast be like, hey, have you seen this?
Right.
Because that's usually like, oh, okay. This because uh-huh. if someone takes the time,
yeah.
you know it's going to be good.
Yeah.
And then I watched it and I was like, what the fuck is happening?
Right.
In this documentary. And then I watched it again uh-huh. with even more stuff I had missed the first time.
Yeah.
With even more like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Like, this is insane. What yeah. an insane story.
Yeah. I watched it again yesterday, too, just to kind of refresh because it's been a month or so. And it had been sitting in my Netflix list forever. And I was like, I was going on a flight and I was like, oh, I'm going to watch this on this flight. It's perfect length. And yeah, I'm sitting on this plane just like with my mouth dropped to my tray. Watching this thing, because I mean, I've always found that to be such a weird, unique, anomalous song. You know, it's about Lion Sleeps Tonight, sort of,
kind of.
Well, yeah.
later on,
yeah. And I mean, it was one of those songs where I mean, I can remember listening to it, sitting in the backseat of my parents' station wagon. They're listening to the oldies station,
right?
And it's on between, you know, the Beatles and the Stones, and then all of a sudden,
yeah.
And I'm like, what the hell is this? Even as a kid, I'm like, this is so weird for this time period, for this song to exist, that it's always been a fascinating song for me to find out how the heck did that come about? Because I mean, it's obviously like a novelty song. I always put it in the same category as like Alley Oop or, you know, something like that, where it's just this weird, the song that came out of nowhere and it was a one hit wonder and you never heard from the Tokens again.
Right.
And,
thank God.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It was so great to see the singer from the Tokens in the documentary. I was like, that's the guy. Oh, man, you could be uglier back then and be a rock star.
God bless the 70s. Yeah.
And do you remember the first time you heard the song?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember being a kid and having it on a 45.
Really?
And Harry Nielsen's Put a Lime in the Coconut,
okay,
which I thought were kind of the same people singing the same song. I thought it was the same group.
Uh-huh.
I remember that being like, it's the same person. It's the same song, basically. Yeah. You know, but and then the Witch Doctor.
Oh, one. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Those songs. Like, those were all kind of my childhood songs.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, that totally makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, I was just, because you're a music guy.
Yeah.
And it was always like, I was like, as the more I got into music, the more I would go back to that song and go, how does this even make sense in, was it 1965, I think, was the Tokens version?
Yeah.
And I just, where does that even come from? And so as soon as I popped on this documentary, I was like, oh.
Yeah. Okay, so let me ask you this. Did you know that it was about, did you know The Lion's Share was about this song before you started watching it? Or did you be like, okay, I'm not sure what's going on?
I had read the synopsis and it said, oh, it's about the lion sleeps tonight. And I was like, perfect. And I wasn't into the idea enough to watch it immediately, but I was like, I want to watch this at some point and find out what's going on with this. And that's why it sat there for so long.
Well, the synopsis doesn't really do a great job of telling you exactly what's happening in this documentary.
It
I would have completely skipped over this song,
uh-huh,
thinking that it was like, oh, it's a guy that like found the original manuscript or whatever, or songbook or something.
Uh-huh.
Like, not that it gets to the depth of, and this is what I wrote earlier, it's about, so... If, for those who are interested in heritage, songwriting, royalties, legalities, lawyers, money, family, and taking on Disney,
yes,
you will love The Lion's Share because it's like, oh, fuck, this documentary is one of those classic ones that literally has everything in it. And there's so many topics and themes that run through this, you know.
I had it mentioned even Disney in the synopsis. I'm a Disney nerd. I would have been like, now I have to watch it right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
okay.
And so... It's so weird because nobody did anything illegal in the whole story.
Let me process that for a second because I didn't think about that. Nobody did anything illegal. So Disney.
Did not. Because Disney only was going based on the rights that they knew
about.
So
they didn't know.
Right. Because at that point, nobody knew. They didn't know. They were going on, Pete Seeger... and the Tokens and, they were probably paying George Weiss, the songwriter guy, because he did own all the rights to the song at that point. So they were probably paying out George Weiss, but they had no idea who the songwriter was. Oh, I'm spacing on his name now. Solomon Linda.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So they had no idea who Solomon Linda was.
No. Okay. That's an interesting point. I never thought. But Paul Campbell. So there's the fake... arranger guy.
Yeah.
The Alan Smithy.
Yeah, exactly. The music version of Alan Smithy.
But for good songs, I guess, that would pay out, which, so is that not illegal?
No, not really, because if it's a real public domain piece of music and I do a version of it, then I can claim a copyright as arranger.
Interesting.
And then it's basically like that version and that recording. So if I go do a public domain song, I can claim arranger rights and I can claim sound recording rights as a copyright, and then I own that, and then I can get a piece of the action anytime somebody does something based on my version.
Got it.
And so that's what they were doing.
I see. Okay, so now for those people who are tuning in and have not seen The Lion's Share, we've completely confused them because this doc has everything, does not have to be chronological, but why don't you give people the synopsis of what this doc is from like start to finish.
Okay, so there's the song The Lion Sleeps Tonight, which right? Turns out none of those words are real.
Right.
Like not even the real words of the song or real words at all.
Right.
And so they track the beginning of the song. The main character or the main player in the thing is Rian Milan, who is a rock journalist, wrote for Rolling Stone, all this kind of stuff. And he's
ethnomusicologist.
Ethnomusicologist. Also, his dad was responsible for apartheid, which they open with that, and you're like, whoa, this is going way deep, way fast.
Right.
And so he tracks back the origins of this song to Solomon Linda, and it's a song called Mbube from South Africa. And it's 1939, right. I think, was when that came out. And that one song inspired a whole genre of music in South Africa, which they even called Mbube. And then, you know, it came through some other
names. Which
means
names, lion in which Zulu.
Which means lion, yeah. And so there's this weird thread of lion going through it, even though it has nothing to do with sleeping, you know. And right. And so he tracks it back. He finds out that Solomon Linda really never got any money for this song, because he accidentally signed his rights away to the publishing company in South Africa, which the music then ended up in the U.S. And it gets in front of Alan Lomax and
who is a South African ethnomusicologist. No.
Lomax is mostly an American ethnomusicologist.
Right, he's the American one.
Right. And who was the guy that did the Pete Seeger, right? So Pete Seeger does a version of it that becomes a hit. The Tokens do it. A parade of white people destroy this song, which is really an underlying theme of the whole film, is that, man, white people do some messed up stuff.
Right.
And
yes. And it's an underlining theme to music in general.
In general, yes.
Stealing from black artists, white people making money off the hard work of black artists.
Exactly.
And talent.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. And so Rian Milan tracks back this thing, and they end up hiring lawyers to try and, you know, bring this song back to South Africa. It turns out it's a really important song to South Africa in general. And they end up suing Disney to, not so much for the money. The money was there, but more to have a high profile case that would then lock the song back into South Africa.
Because Disney was using it for The Lion King.
For The Lion King.
For the huge, mega animated hit.
Yeah,
Lion King.
And the Broadway show.
And then the Broadway show.
Yeah.
Right, yes. So, and then, right, we open on Rian Milan, who kind of looks like a very, his opening remarks is like, I drink a lot, I smoke cigarettes, I write.
Yeah.
You know, like,
he's the most transparent person I've ever seen in a documentary.
Holy crap.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I just submit this, Phil, how happy I was that this music documentary didn't have the typical talking heads of like Sting, Bono,
sure,
you know, like those guys,
right.
You know, like we'd see Bruce Springsteen be like, I always loved Solomon Linda,
right.
You know, like I had a signed copy of it.
Right. Yeah. The only one they had was the guy that leads Ladysmith, Black Mambazo.
Oh, right.
Right.
Which is who
Which
you should
fits.
Have.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Because he's from South Africa.
Right.
Right. I'm so sick of music documentaries that just like march out the usual suspects.
Sure.
And it's usually Bono for some reason.
Right.
The man has too much time on his hands. He's in all of them.
Yeah.
You know? But I was just, because it does not have, has a very low budget feel.
Yes.
This documentary, which makes it even, I think, an even more palatable watch.
Yeah.
It's not flashy. It's not shiny. It doesn't have animation and graphs and stuff.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's a very low budget, very well paced as far as filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And very, there were times, especially in the first watch, where I was kind of confused about what was going on.
Uh-huh.
There were moments when I was just like, I didn't understand a lot of the legality stuff. I didn't think they did a great job of really explaining what was happening. And also I was confused of the time period. Like, where are we right now?
Yeah.
It goes back and forth.
It does flip around. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, what year are we in? And I'm still not even sure until the end when they go March 2018. You're like, okay, finally.
Yeah.
I think
a lot of it was happening. Okay. Well, if they're suing Disney around Lion King and the Broadway show was already happening, then we're talking at least late 90s.
Well, and he wrote the piece for Rolling Stone in 2000.
Okay, right.
Yeah,
right.
And he called out Disney then.
Okay.
And then the Broadway thing came out.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so it is a little hard to follow time-wise. The legality stuff, I don't know, I guess I've played around with copyright and trademark and stuff
you've written songs and,
that I kind of understood. I thought it was fascinating the way they finally dug up that old UK law from Charles Dickens.
What the fuck?
That applied. And I didn't understand is how you apply a UK law to South African law unless there was some sort of colonial connection there or something like that. But
that's all I could think. But yeah. That's Dutch, right? But I guess,
oh, that would be Dutch, yeah.
But the British fucking colonized everything.
Yeah, so they were probably there at some point.
They're like, oh, right, yeah, yeah. We got this. Probably. I didn't understand. That's the stuff I'm kind of talking about, too. Is like, I didn't quite understand how they could do that unless it was like a universal law or something.
Right. I didn't know how they could connect it. I understood the use of the law. That was funny because at the end when the lawyers talk about, well, there's only a few lawyers in the world who would, you know, be able to navigate this case. And I was like, I get it how you did it.
Right.
Because the law essentially extends the copyright 25 years additional past the life of the songwriter so that the heirs can make some money off of it. And that totally makes sense. Ironically, it's completely the same idea as Disney's always pushing on our copyright laws here. Where they're always trying to extend copyright, which as a copyright owner, I'm okay with.
Yeah.
You know, here they always call it, oh, it's a Mickey Mouse law. It's a Mickey Mouse copyright law, you know? It sort of got bitten by their own,
right.
got bitten by their own legal.
Hoisted by legal their own petard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Whatever that saying is.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, they got hit with their same thought process, which I thought was funny, but it was, yeah, so some of that stuff could be, if you're not familiar with copyright law and things like that, can be a little bit hard to navigate in the film. But I got it. I didn't even think about it that much.
Yeah, it kind of confused me a little bit. But like the documentary is pretty awesome because you don't see that kind of coming. I certainly didn't see that part.
Yeah,
like if you're going to break it up in Act One, Act Two, Act Three. Like in Act One, we learn a lot about the song itself.
Mm-hmm.
They show literally 12 people, different groups and things of singing the song over the years.
Some of them so bad.
Oh, yeah.
So bad.
So bad. And I even did some research. I found a Brian Eno version.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah. I'm like, and a lion sleeps. But it has the Brian Eno like...
Okay, yeah.
But it has the like sweet melody.
Uh-huh.
He didn't fuck with the song at all. He just did some weird rhythm shit.
Okay.
And then I think it's the Vinyls. Do you remember that? They're like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
They're like, I think just a acapella group.
Okay. Yeah.
They did a pretty hit, but there's the Tokens, NSYNC, Henry Salvador. They showed the Friends singing.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And then like, so it's pretty interesting to hear like the etymology of like the Wimowe from Umbabwe, Umbube. Umbube. Thank you.
And in the original song, it's Oyo Umbube,
which is like I am a lion or something.
I am a lion, or you are a lion, or something like that.
Somebody's a lion.
Yeah, where the daughters were like, no, it was a song about him like building himself up. Where the backs around singers are going, you're a lion, you're a lion, I'm a lion. You know, it was a bragging song of sorts that they were writing. I don't know if they were writing it in the studio. I know he riffed the melody.
Right. He basically improvised.
Yeah. It was melody. Like the second of three takes or something like that. The archivist was saying in there, you know, where, I mean, and when you listen to that melody, it's funny because when you hear a melody like that and you hear the original one and you're like, oh, that's not that catchy, but it got refined and refined and refined and refined as it was done over and over and over again until you get, you know, the one in the Tokens version, which is kind of the one that everybody thinks about.
Yeah.
And, we don't bomb away, you know, and that's so catchy. And you hear the first one, you're like, oh, I can hear the seed of that catchiness in there, you know, which kind of, it makes me think about, you know, that song Torn by, well, the Natalie Imbruglia version is one that everybody knows.
Yeah.
Right. So that song was originally done by a group named Edna Swap, who did it on every album they put out. Like I have six different versions of Edna Swap doing Torn. And then Natalie Imbruglia does it and it's huge.
Just blows up.
Yeah. Right. And what they did in the Natalie Imbruglia version is they took this little melody that was buried in the mix at the end of the Edna Swap version and they popped it out front.
Oh.
And it turned out to be a super catchy melody.
The hook.
That became the melodic hook around the vocals. And Edna Swap never pulled that melody out. It was just kind of buried in the mix in the coda of the song, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's kind of that same thing where I listen back and I go, oh, there's that melody. They just popped it out and made it a more prominent part of the mix.
Interesting.
You know? And so it was that kind of thing where you hear that sort of prototypical melody at the in that original recording.
Huh.
And then it pops out later and you're like, oh, that's the part, you know?
Right. That's really, it's always interesting. I remember when I found out like Led Zeppelin, like most of their songs are covers.
Right.
In the early stages.
Certainly. Yeah.
You know, like they stole from like old blues singers,
yeah.
You know, black African-American blues singers.
Yep.
And I don't think got any money from some of that stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it depends on who it is with those British bands.
Yeah.
I don't know the Led Zeppelin background. Like this, all those black artists were very thankful of the Stones. The Stones were very supportive of them.
Yes.
Because they would take them out on the road, have them open. You know, they were very upfront about, no, this isn't our song. This is a Howlin' Wolf song or whatever
right.
You know, Zeppelin, I don't think was quite as truthful.
Like When the Levee Breaks, I think is like a great Mama Thornton song.
I think so.
I'm like, God damn it.
Right.
Like, I really want to like these guys, but
yeah.
Jesus Christ, can you at least credit them?
Right.
You know, like what's they're multi-millionaires.
Sure.
Break off a couple mil
right.
for some of these guys. You know, it's like, I truly do not get that mentality.
Yeah, I don't either.
Of just being like, fuck you.
Right.
We're going to take this. We're rock stars mm-hmm. and who cares about it? Like, it doesn't make, I feel like I watched a documentary where the Stones paid like Sun Studios operating costs for a year or something like that.
Oh, really?
That.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Like one of those Southern classic studios was going under and the Stones just paid their
right.
operating cost.
Right. I think I do know that story.
Yeah.
I think I read about it in a Sun book. Yeah.
Right.
So it's kind of difficult for me to think of a song that has covered greater distance in both time and space. It became the most famous melody ever to emerge from Africa, and also probably the most lucrative. But not if you were a poor black person in Johannesburg.
Solomon Linda was the father of the genre.
The famous melody mutated into The Lion Sleeps Tonight that went on to earn $16 million, almost none of which came back to him after he died to his descendants in South Africa.
One of the largest exploiters of the song was, in fact, Disney.
Copyright infringement took place. Damages were incurred.
From there, it was like throwing a match into a lake of gasoline.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I want to know more about like your musical background. Like, when did you start? Did you start on guitar? Or?
No, I was a flautist originally. cut to fourth grade.
Yeah.
There's
smash cut.
Smash cut to fourth grade. There's music lessons happening at school. My mom goes, she goes, do you want to play music? And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I guess. And she goes, well, girls like musicians. And I was like, cool, sign me up.
Right. There you go.
Fourth grade. I was ready to go. And she goes, what do you want to play? And I said, I don't know. They were offering, I think, clarinet and flute and maybe trumpet or something like that. She goes, well, look, if you play the flute, you'll always be the only boy in the section. And I was like, cool, sign me up.
Oh, your mom.
She knew, right? Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
She was pimping you out, man. That's awesome.
She knew where my brain was even in fourth grade. And it was true. I was always the only boy in the flute section all the way through college. And so I played a ton of flute, orchestras, all that kind of stuff. We did Wagner at the Palace of Fine Arts here in San Francisco.
Well.
It was fantastic, all that kind of stuff. And it was great. So I had years of that. I picked up the piano, I think, when I was 12, guitar when I was 16, and then just, you know, went from there. I was always a hobby musician until, I sort of got in the heavy metal world as a teenager, and I was like, I think I want to do this,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's when it really kind of took off. I never started a band till college.
Okay.
And then I went from there, and then eventually started performing solo, and that kind of morphed into comedy.
Right, right. You know? Okay.
I just wanted to be the guitar player in a rock band. That's all I ever wanted.
So how do you go from like a 4-piece, 5-piece metal rock band to solo to comedy?
Well, I had split off. I mean, we were doing like, my band Roadside Attraction was doing like sort of funky rock stuff. A little bit of Red Hot Chili Peppers mixed in a little classic rock, that kind of thing. And I had split off with the guys that I was working with in my band. And I tried to find a singer, worked with a couple different singers, and it was just me and them for a while. And I was just having trouble getting it going. The whole time I'm just demoing out tracks myself, just getting stuff out of my head. And I wrote a couple of funny songs that were in there. And I was like, nah, these will be B-sides or something like that. And just throw away kind of tracks.
Yeah.
And eventually I got talked into being a singer because everybody was like, look, we've heard your demos. They're good enough. Just be a singer. And I was like, I don't want to be a singer. They're like, just be a singer. I was like, all right, I'll be a singer. And did not want to do that. I'm not a trained singer. I'm trained in lots of other things. I got a degree in jazz guitar. I am not a trained singer. And so it was literally just going to my studio and singing and playing guitar for 6 hours a day.
Oh, wow.
Before going in to spend $10,000 recording an album.
Right.
And so that's the way I became a singer. But I had written these couple of goofy songs, and I was at a music convention in Las Vegas that my mentor, Tim Sweeney, was putting on. And we're sitting around the pool, the hotel. We actually got kicked out of 4 or 5 different places around the hotel because we were being too loud. and we were just trading songs, all these musicians that were there. You know, oh, I got a song. I got a song. We're just jamming. And I played a song for the group called Whale Blubber, which is a love song based on a line from the Jim Carrey film, Me, Myself, and Irene, where they're sitting by the lake and they're talking about, she goes, oh, if I moved to Alaska, would you go with me? And he goes, yes, but would you eat whale blubber for me? And my girlfriend and I were like, that's a song. And so that became the hook of the song. Would you eat whale blubber for me?
Nice.
And so I wrote that, and I had a couple other like funny songs, and I was going to B-side them. But this group that I would play it for at this music conference was like, no, we can't get those stupid songs out of our head. Like the next morning, everybody was like, we're still singing the whale blubber song. And I was like, nah, garbage songs, B-sides. And they're like, no, seriously, you might pursue that. And then my mentor got wind of it, and he was like, I think this is a good idea for you to do. And I was like, but I got a band. I finally got the band back together. They're perfect. I love all these guys. They're great. And I said, I'll start doing half solo gigs and half band gigs. And he's like, great. In 3 months, you'll be doing all solo gigs.
Right.
And so I started doing the coffee shop scene, playing my straight songs, throwing in a couple goofy songs, started talking in between. I had a really bad habit of forgetting lyrics, and I would make a joke of it when I forgot the lyrics, to the point where everybody expected me to forget the lyrics, like it was part of the show.
And really,
it was me just forgetting the lyrics, yeah. You know. And so then I got invited to play, do you remember the Hyena Theater here in San Francisco?
Yes, okay. I do.
They were doing a comedy music night. And my friend Groovy Judy called me and said, hey, they're doing a comedy music night. You might see if you can get on the bill. And Judy still plays around here, too. She's great. And so I got on that. That was my first, like, legit comedy gig. I still have a recording of it. It's painful to listen to.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they all are.
And so the MC that night was Lynn Ruth Miller.
Oh, wow.
And she was like,
when she was like 60?
Yeah, right. Yeah, she was only 104 at the time.
Right.
And she goes, I need a guitar player for my act. Do you want to come play guitar for me? And I was like, yeah, okay.
Oh,
I was
wow.
open to doing anything,
sure.
You know, at that point. I was in a real just floating down the stream kind of phase.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, great. I'll go play guitar with her. And we were doing this thing where I'd play Anarchy in the UK by the Sex Pistols. And she would throw lingerie at the audience, bras
nice.
And things like that. And it was
yeah.
very funny. It was fun. And so she started taking me around to places like Ron's Farmhouse, like we were talking about a little while ago. And she would go, hey, you know, he's got some funny songs. Why don't you give him a set? She like really pushed people to throw me on stage. And they're like, can you do 7 minutes? And I was like, yeah, I did like 4 hours with my band last weekend. I can do 7 minutes.
Yeah.
And then you find out how long 7 minutes
is. It's a long time.
You know? And so I lived on 3 songs for the first 2 years, I think.
Right.
Just playing these couple of 3 songs I had.
Yeah.
That were funny. And then caught a lot of all the guitar comic flack from the traditionalists. And I was
hate it.
Yeah. And I was like, I'm going to learn how to do this. It looks like I'm doing this. I'm going to learn how to do this. And
yeah.
I just started working on the stand-up portion of the show.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, so it was just, to me, it was all the same thing. Like I was going to open mics and setting up a merch table because I already had stuff to sell. You know, I already had CDs and whatever. And
yeah.
Everybody's like, who's this dude?
Yeah.
You know? And so to me, it was just another place to play and kind of do the same thing that I was already doing.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Who were, did you have like people that you looked up to, like, you know, music comics that you could listen to and
not really.
Or were they just were you like a stand up fan, or is it just like one of those natural progressions?
No, I was totally a stand up fan since I was a kid. You know, I could recite, you know, Robin Williams Live at the Met back to front,
yeah,
and things like that. And but I never thought I'd be doing it.
Right.
You know, that never even entered my brain at all. I was a Weird Al fan, but I never thought I'd, you know, I right. still don't do parody because Weird Al does it better than I'm gonna ever do it.
Yeah.
You know? So I still don't do parody stuff. That's why I do the original stuff.
Right.
And so I was a fan. Like I didn't know Stephen Lynch until after I started doing it.
Okay.
Yeah. And people would go, "Oh, you're kind of like Stephen Lynch." Right. And then I was like, "I don't know who the Stephen Lynch guy is."
Right.
And then I listened and I was like, "Oh, this is yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
this is great."
Stephen talks about, I'm good friends with Stephen Lynch for those people who are listening, and he's talked to me about the comic versus musician comic
yeah.
thing, uh-huh. you know, and how he had always kind of fight through, because in his mind, he's more of a musician that just kind of writes funny songs.
Sure, yeah.
He's not really, in his mind, a comedian
right.
first. And that's why he's never done clubs. He only right. does theaters, because yeah. he's like, I'm not a comic.
Uh-huh.
I'm a musician that writes silly songs,
right.
you know. So he kind of went through the same thing. And I think Bo Burnham has helped mm-hmm. a lot to sure. like kind of fuse that into people's brains that you can do right. both. I mean,
yeah.
I've never understood, I mean, outside of maybe prop comics, but like people who do something else on stage, it's
yeah.
like, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun to watch.
If you've got another skill, use it.
Absolutely. You know? And that's what I remember. I think Will Durst told me once, someone when I first started, because I used to play guitar. When I first started, I went by the name Free Dirt. That was my stage okay. name. And I would ask people suggestions
uh-huh.
and I'd riff off those suggestions and just improvise a song. That
okay.
was my thing when uh-huh. I first started. And I put it down. I did a show with Will Durst once doing that, and he's like, "That was awesome." I'm like, "Yeah, I'm just going to stop. I'm going to just do stand up."
Uh-huh.
And he was like, "No, you should, anything you do, you should do it on stage."
Sure.
If you yeah. whistle, if you tap dance,
right.
you know.
Yeah.
Throw it in your act, man.
Right.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always I keep going, I want to learn like a magic trick. Just one that I could throw in the act somewhere that would be cool. And almost just as a throwaway, like not even acknowledge that I just did a magic trick.
Right.
And, you know, and just have people yeah. go, "Wait, did that just happen?"
Well,
you know?
Yeah. Well, and then, I mean, ask Amazing Jonathan if it didn't work out for him.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
like the guy's living in a giant mansion in Las Vegas.
Right. Yes.
High off his mind on meth. But
right.
that's beside the point. Have you seen that documentary?
I did. I just watched it last week. Yeah.
Oh,
really good.
Awesome.
Yeah. Steve Byrne did a great job on that.
He did. Did you yeah. see the Counterpoint one?
No.
There's a second Amazing Jonathan documentary on Hulu.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So when Steve Byrne's making his.
Yeah.
Jonathan hired a second documentary film crew to make
really?
It.
Really?
And that one's on Hulu. And
oh,
you
I'll have to watch that.
Definitely watch that one.
Oh,
well. Because it's the other side of
okay.
it. Yeah. Steve Burns is more of like almost a love letter
sure.
to Amazing Jonathan. The other one, not so much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Oh, yeah, I'll
it's
have
like
to watch
the
that.
Fire Festival
oh, yeah, sure.
competing documentaries.
Right.
You know, it kind of does the same thing.
Yeah.
So we have like a classic, The Lion's Share, this documentary on Netflix, is a very classic tale that's been told a lot, basically, about, you know, impoverished African-American, well, not African-American at this point, but
yeah,
let's just
African.
Say African, yeah. actually, yeah. just African, like talented person that puts something out and then makes someone asks them to sign a contract, which is basically signs all their rights away,
right?
Unbeknownst to them,
that was the point right there where you go, okay, not illegal, but definitely
unethical.
sketchy, definitely unethical. Yeah.
Well, and then you find part we haven't really talked about yet is his three daughters that we see. They're talking heads in this documentary,
yeah.
and one of them's like, he couldn't read, he couldn't write,
right.
So and then they show the contract,
the
and it's like a nice cursive
uh-huh.
in cursive. I'm like, it's in cursive for
right.
Christ's sakes. For a guy who can't write, he's like, let me just write this in cursive.
Right.
You
yeah.
know,
it would have either been print, straight print, or an X.
Well, yeah.
You know?
Well, and she said like they used to write an X or like a thumbprint.
Right.
They used to put like a thumbprint down
uh-huh.
instead, which
yeah.
is like so smart.
Right.
You know, like that is
that's trackable.
That's very trackable.
Yeah.
yeah. And we find out from these daughters like that he died super poor. Mm-hmm. You know, like when he died, they couldn't afford to put a tombstone on his grave, like where he was buried, and that he had no idea that you could make money from just singing a song.
Right.
There was no, he did not understand that. And he did not know that the song that he had made had gone on to make lots of people very wealthy.
Yeah.
And then by another, there's a lot of surprises in this doc. Another big surprise is that he worked for that record company.
Oh yeah. As a, he was packing records.
He was packing records for the, for that record. They gave him a job.
Right.
Which I was like, God, that is just so, is that evil? I can't, like, what is, I couldn't really figure that one out. I'm like, were they trying to keep him close, you know? Have you seen Searching for Sugar Man?
Not yet, no.
That documentary?
Yeah.
You should watch that documentary because it's very similar in tone. Uh-huh. It's about South Africa and about music and stuff. It's a very great documentary.
Nice.
Yeah, it's definitely one you should check out.
Well, I mean, the funny thing about, you know, I mean, getting an artist, getting a songwriter to sign away their rights is that is, that is not just a black artist thing. That is an every artist thing. That is, I mean, there's so many stories of record labels just shafting the artist because the artist doesn't know enough about what's going on.
Never. Never does. They never do.
Yeah.
I mean, famously, Billy Joel had to make a couple fortunes in his life.
Sure.
Because he lost a couple early on. Like the very first one, I think his manager took everything. Mm-hmm. Right? And he didn't own any of the rights to his own music and lost millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And then had to come back with some other hits.
Yeah.
You know, like,
oh, yeah.
Can you imagine being that talented? We were like, fuck, okay, I got to write some more hits.
Right.
You know, I guess I got to pay my rent. Here comes some hits.
Here comes some hits. Yeah, well, I mean, I remember hearing stories about like Blink-182, like playing for sold out arenas and not being able to buy groceries in between road dates. You
That's
know,
it's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not sure how they're going to get to their next arena show.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I worked for a couple labels. When I first moved to San Francisco, I was in the music business and I worked for two record labels, and it is a crappy business.
It is.
People do not quite, if you don't have a lawyer with you to look over those contracts, they're built to shaft you. I mean, it's literally the mob. It's like a mob thing where they're like, we will loan you. This is a loan.
Yep.
This, we're fronting you this money.
Mm-hmm.
It's a loan. And if your first album or second album doesn't do well, then you're going to have to create more albums to pay us back at some point.
Yeah.
So, like, I remember reading once that most bands have to have five albums to break even.
Sure.
Which is crazy.
There were times when I could have had a major label deal.
Oh, wow.
And I was working with my mentor, who I mentioned earlier, Tim Sweeney. And he came from, he was a guy that came from the major label side of things. He was a fix-it guy at Mercury Records for bands that weren't selling.
Oh.
So he would learn all about that stuff and then come to us indie artists and go, okay, here's what you need to do to avoid being that band that I got to go fix at Mercury Records. And so there were times where it's like, okay, Tim, I've got, you know, people I'm talking to and things like that. And he'd be like, okay, you could sign a deal like this and here's what's going to happen. Or you can put this record out yourself and make way more money.
So what was some, like, if you can impart on some valuable advice right now to people who are listening, they're like, what is that advice?
Well, I mean, now it's more commonplace. Now it's, you know, put the record out yourself.
Okay.
All the distribution is out there. I mean, when I was learning that stuff, it was the late 90s, you know, and it was not, I mean, CD Baby was so new that...
Has it been around that long?
It has, yeah.
Oh,
so
wow.
Derek Sivers, who started CD Baby... who is now sort of this weird mystical guru who lives in New Zealand, I think.
Of course.
Derek is the greatest guy. He started CD Baby just as a site to sell his friends' CDs online. He figured out how to, you know, hack together enough code to sell some CDs online.
Right.
When e-commerce was a new thing.
Brand new.
Yeah. So that started to go. And so he did this national tour where he would go around and gather the local musicians and go, okay, here's this thing we're doing where we can sell your CDs online. And he would go around city to city educating us all about this. He came here to San Francisco and gathered a bunch of us around. And he was the greatest guy. Like, to this day, if I walked up to Derek Sivers, he would go, oh, hey, Phil. And I haven't seen him in 20 years probably.
Right.
But he has this magnetic, this just photographic memory for people where he would like, oh, you were wearing that same shirt last time I saw you 10 years ago. You know, I mean,
yeah.
And I would go, oh, I've been wearing this shirt for 10 years. Yeah. And, you know, but he's like one of those people where you're just like, how does he do that?
Yeah.
You know, met thousands of people. And so now the site's owned by disc makers, I guess.
Oh, okay.
But he started it, and that was the beginning of learning how to do that self-release kind of thing, which wasn't a thing really. You had to have some sort of label. But now distribution is so easy. You know, you can put a record out, you can put a single out, and have it on every streaming site in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's super easy.
I put out my comedy album on through CD Baby.
Yeah.
And they do the digital distribution thing. And it was on things I'd been like, oh, I don't, what is this?
Right.
What is this thing that it is on?
Some weird Korean music streaming site. Yeah.
Yeah. I just feel like my songs are now full of viruses and Trojans and horses and whatever. Just like, whoa, what is this site?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very, I just got my digital distribution check from CD Baby like 2 weeks ago. I put it on Facebook because I was like, look at the money. It's all like 0.01 from like all these weird sites and stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't realize CD Baby was around that long. I remember when I worked at Ubiquity Records, the first record company I worked at here, and it was 1999.
Yeah.
I remember two distinct things. The first is we got a one-time CD burner.
Okay.
So it was one-to-one.
Uh-huh.
You put the CD in and you put the, then there was a second second console for the burner.
Okay.
And it took just as long as the CD to burn it. So it was a one-time and it was like $600.
Yep.
And the boss at Ubiquity was like, nobody touched this. Nobody use it for anything except for like, we're making, copies to send to press and stuff.
Right.
But it took, and if it was an hour-long CD, it took an hour to burn it.
Oh,
that was
God.
The first thing. And the second one, I remember we had a huge meeting about whether or not we should sell stuff online.
Because
he was just like, it's a scam. It doesn't work. Nobody buys things on. I still remember this meeting because we were just like, should we take this risk and put a shopping cart, you know, on the website?
Uh-huh.
I was like, well, who does that?
Right.
You know? Is that weird?
It's so weird to think of it now.
20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and then it's Black Friday, basically. We're recording this Black Friday weekend. We're like, nobody went to a physical location this weekend.
Not at all. No. I was Christmas shopping on Amazon this morning.
Hell yeah, dude. Me too. Got some New Balance in the mail.
Yeah.
That's just so weird, dude. Like you've been in both comedy and music for a very interesting period of time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, from the late 90s to the late 2010s, there's been such a huge change.
Oh, yeah. And constantly feeling just slightly behind the curve at all times.
Always, of course.
You get just like, okay, I just figured out how to do this.
Oh, nobody what the hell uses this? That.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
You still use that?
Yeah. It's like there's always, it moves so fast now where you're just like, oh, okay, now what? I got TikTok. All right, I got to figure out TikTok.
Oh,
you know,
Jesus. Yeah, I can't even. Yeah, I don't even. I can't do that stuff anymore. I felt like when I finally figured out like Twitter and I remember MySpace when I finally was like, oh, I've got like, I don't remember how many friends or whatever the MySpace thing was, you know? And then I remember, you know, Facebook came around. I'm like, fuck, you know, I got to figure out Vine. Like I've just stopped. I'm like, I can't just keep going with that stuff.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
I hope this doesn't sound funny, but I really believe that I am a vessel through which the good Lord sends thoughts, impulses, creations through. It comes through me, not from me, through me. And I give credit for everything that I write to something or someone else, and not me.
All right, so back to The Lion's Share. So Act One is basically we learn about the song. We learn about all the people that did it. We learn that it was a big song in South Africa that, like you said, it started like a trend. Act Two, we find out more about the bands that did the song and the people that kind of like latched onto it and made some money, which I do want to talk about George Weiss, who was like a famous arranger. Mm-hmm. And someone that the labels would have to like help out bands. Is that about right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he kind of came in as a songwriter for the Token Session. And because they said, well, we've got this, you know, song that Pete Seeger had done it. A few other people had hits with it, you know, and then they were doing their version of it. And they brought him in as a lyricist. And he wrote these lyrics, which is the verse of the song, which is the part that didn't exist before. In the jungle, the mighty jungle, all that stuff. And so he wrote that stuff. And the singer of the Tokens goes, well, this doesn't fit the melody at all, which is exactly what you want from a lyricist.
Thanks, George.
Thanks, George. Well, this doesn't. And so he basically sat around the piano and figured out the melody for the lyrics that he did write, which is almost sort of a Bernie Taupin, Elton John way of going about things. Here's the words. Now figure out how to stuff them into a song.
Yeah.
And so they wrote the words, and then that became, you know, that big hit for the Tokens. And so that changed the song in a very fundamental way, where it was no longer not only Weemaway, which isn't a word.
Right.
You know, I was always confused when I was a kid whether it was Weemaway or Weemawep. I couldn't tell if there was a P at the end of it, but it's Weemaway.
Yeah.
That was a change from Mbube. And so now it's almost completely a different piece of music.
Right.
But still relating all the way back to this original 1939 track, you know. So George Weiss ends up claiming for the lyrics as owner. He's at some point, they don't really explain how he gets to this point, but he ends up with all the rights to the song.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Not the Tokens don't get anything.
The Tokens don't get squat out of it.
Not even like a performance.
They might get some sort of performance royalty.
Percentage on the
right, because in publishing rights it's a 50-50 split between writers and performers, which is why I am writer and performer.
There you go.
And then I get all the money.
Yeah.
All the little bits of money, all
performed
those,
by written by,
yeah, all those little fractions of a cent from Spotify.
Yeah.
And so I imagine they might get something from the performer side of that, but maybe the label took it from them as well. So a lot of those, especially one hit wonder bands from the 60s, didn't end up with a lot from their one hit.
Right.
Because their contracts were so slanted towards the label that there's, you know, I mean, like you were saying, it takes five albums to break even. They got one song.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, they're done.
That maybe, you know, did something. So they can still go out and tour on it.
Right.
And they do. They show up at the Santa Cruz Boardwalk every other year in the summer concert series, you know?
Yeah, they do.
You know?
Star rockets in flight. Yeah, just singing their song.
Oh, my God. I haven't heard Afternoon Delight in years. My parents had that on their jukebox
when I was a kid. It's about fucking.
It totally is.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. That was the best.
I was this old when I found out that it was about fucking. Like, I just realized that the other day. I'm like, oh, it's Afternoon Delight.
Yeah.
Oh.
Strangely, my parents explained that stuff I was a kid.
Your parents are pretty cool, man.
They are. Yeah. They still have a jukebox, like a legit, like 1967 Wurlitzer at their house.
Oh, wow.
That works. And so we would listen to all the old 45s and stuff that they had in there. So they had Afternoon Delight in there. And my mom, I think my mom explained that one to me. She also explained to me Brand New Key by Melanie.
Uh-huh.
I got a brand new rose key. You got a brand new key. She was like, yeah, that's about sex. And I was like, what? roller skates and keys.
Yeah.
I didn't even know what a roller skate key was. Yeah, are you kidding?
Right.
And she explained to me, like, she was like, oh yeah, it's about that key hole. I was like, oh, okay. I'm 8. All right. <You
know? laughs> Right. Wow. I didn't know. Are all songs about sex?
I think so. Yeah.
Oh my God.
My girlfriend still doesn't believe me that Little Red Corvette is about sex.
Little Red Corvette.
Yeah. She's like, no, it's about a car. I'm like, nope.
It is? Oh no. Prince wrote a song about sex.
I would never have guessed.
No.
Gotta cast this dog. Gotta cast this dog.
So who would play Ryan Milan? You had no time to think about
Mark
this.
Mark Maron comes to mind. Just kind of the look.
Oh, fuck.
Scraggle him up a little bit more. But he might be a little too manic.
No, that's perfect. Wow, good job. Right off the spot. Like, that's pretty. I was thinking of David Carradine.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
David Carradine. Yeah.
Alive and. Because he has that kind of like soft spoken kind of look to him. But Mark Maron would be perfect, actually. is there anyone else in this we could think of that? What about the copyright lawyer? I guess that could be
the high price, the gray haired guy. Oh, that would be.
That could be pretty much anybody, I suppose. But
yeah, I'm trying to think of somebody that's super blowhardy.
He is blowhardy.
Yeah.
He kind of. There is a guy who plays a lawyer in The Sopranos.
Okay. I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
That looks like him. He's got the white hair and stuff. And is so that maybe that could be that guy, whoever that is.
Yeah, somebody IMDb that.
But I think Mark Maron as Ryan Milan is very good. So good job. We played Cast the Stock on the podcast. So act two, we're definitely into kind of the people who are just like stealing the money out of the hands of the Linda family.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's some people like, so here's a little bit on my background. When I was a teenager, I was really into politics and I worked for Howard Wolpe, who is a Michigan legislature. He was not state, but federal. He was in D.C., and he was the guy who pushed the sanctions against South Africa because of apartheid in 1984.
Uh-huh.
And so when I was a teenager, I worked with Howard Wolpe, Democrat, and I remember that's when I first started getting into South Africa and South African politics, and specifically South African music.
Yeah.
So I was a big fan of Soweto music.
Okay.
I still am.
Right.
So Abdullah Ibrahim, Dollar Brand, Johnny Clegg, Ladysmith, Black Mazambo, like those, all those groups I was a big fan of. And I still am. And I love that kind of music.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever get into like the South African sound?
I did. I mean, I studied a little bit of African music in college and did some drumming and things like that. It's really, really difficult stuff.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where I always, when I hear it, I go, oh man, I got to dive more into that. This is really cool stuff. And I've never kind of gotten around to it, but I enjoy that kind of thing.
Yeah,
certainly. The stuff I was studying was more, Western Africa, Ghana, places like that.
Right.
And studying that kind of thing. But, the South African stuff I enjoy. I've never really had a chance to really dive into it though.
Yeah. It's expansive and very impressive. Like the sound, I mean, there's like the Nigerian, like Fela Kuti. And
that stuff is great,
and that kind of stuff. There's Ali Fakatura. A lot of the West African stuff's amazing. But I love gospel.
Okay.
I grew up playing piano in my stepfather's all-black Southern Baptist church. My stepfather's African-American. I grew up playing the piano in an all-black church with this black choir.
Got your 1/4s down.
Do I ever. Do I ever have the 1/4 down, dude? Yeah. And I really got into like gospel growing up, listening to gospel. I love like Cannonball Adderley.
Yes.
Who comes with a Southern Baptist kind of, you know, rhythm to it. And so when I first heard the Soweto stuff coming out of Johannesburg in that area, it has that gospel feel to it, which is like, even if you think about it, the original song that Solomon Linda did with the Evening Birds, it has that kind of, you know, that kind of gospel swing to it, you know?
Yeah, and they're saying, I mean, that's kind of where that came from, is not only that style, but that song.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They're saying that song spawned that genre.
Oh, right. Yeah, that kind of sound.
Yeah.
I mean, even Paul Simon famously picked that up. And you remember, I mean, I guess you're old enough to remember when Paul Simon played in South Africa.
Yep.
People were like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like, well, I don't know if you can do that. Right. You know, remember that? It was like a big deal.
Yeah, certainly.
He went there and recorded and played that live concert.
It was,
people are like, we don't do that.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, it's fucking awesome, I guess, that he did. I love Paul Simon.
Yeah, he's great.
And Graceland and Rhythm of the Saints, those albums, you know, are pretty awesome. So, like, so Act Two is basically the groups, and then we're starting to learn more about the song and who started doing it. And that's when we first get introduced to the sisters.
Yes.
And then, like you said, Ryan Milan, who is, like you said, the most transparent person ever on a documentary. Cause he was like, maybe I'm afraid to go into Johannesburg because I'm white and I have fear of black people.
Yeah.
And like, you're like, what?
Well, there's one time he goes, I love black people and I fear them. And I was like, well, you're never going to hear any white person say that out loud.
No. You know? And he's in South Africa.
Yeah.
You know, and like you said, I think it was his grandpa or his dad, D.F. Milan, who basically was like, let's just do this apartheid thing.
Like, right. Yeah.
He had to live through all that.
And his family had been in South Africa for 300 years.
Right.
You know,
and another tidbit that I almost, like, I didn't even catch it in the first time around, but the second time he said that he wrote for Rolling Stone under a nom de plume, like he wrote under in his fake name. Do you remember his fake name that he used?
Oh, it was, it was Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, right. Like, what? Who is this guy, man? That is so odd. I literally did not pick it up the first time. And the second time I made a note of it because I was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, that is so weird.
Yeah.
That is really strange, but that's awesome in this, you know, the same respect. So we see Ryan Milan driving like years later to go talk to these sisters who he'd been really close to the family.
Right.
And again, the one thing the doc does that's kind of confusing, doesn't really give you a good idea of the time differences.
Mm-hmm.
However, for some reason, and they don't explain this either, there's a lot of footage from him typing in like 1992.
Mm.
Like you see.
Yeah.
Actual archival footage of him typing and writing for the Rolling Stones. And he looks young and he's handsome.
Right.
And, the new lawyer that they get, you see footage of him from years ago. Because they had to get rid of the original lawyer who sounded like a piece of shit.
I don't know if he was a piece of shit. Okay. He just didn't really know what he was doing. He wasn't an IP lawyer.
Okay.
And he was like right from the very beginning, he's like, I don't really know what I'm doing. That's why we had to bring this other guy in, you know?
Uh-huh, yeah.
He was like, you know, I got a buddy who's a lawyer who said he'd help me out, but, you know,
he didn't know quite that.
He had no idea what he's doing, you
know? Yeah. Right, awesome. I guess I'm talking about the original lawyer, because they go to his office and they're like, give us the documents. And
that guy. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. He was shady.
Yeah. He seemed because he was like, here's a slip of paper.
Right. It was like four pieces of paper or something like that. Yeah.
And this was like for like the last 50 years or something where the family was like, we've only gotten like a couple bucks.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, well, here's your receipt.
Right.
Written on a napkin.
Yeah.
And so the dude you're talking about, right, he came in and he was like, I don't really know what I'm doing. However, I'm going to try to help the family out.
Yeah.
And they try to get the documents from them. And then we learn more about the story and the daughters who are like, no one's ever told us anything.
Mm-hmm.
We have no idea what's going on.
Right.
No one's told us anything. We're poor. We grew up, like they say, with dust floors and, you know, barely a fucking roof over their heads. And they're like, help us out. So we see this conversation going on, and then we learn that he writes the story for Rolling Stone and it drums up some attention.
Mm-hmm.
It gets into all these newspapers and stuff. And so they come up with this, like, first of all, Disney wants to just squash it. Like they do.
Sure.
Because they're just like, no.
Yeah.
No, we're not going to do that.
Well, the part that you're almost missing there is how they decided they needed to sue. They wanted to go after Disney because it was high profile.
Right.
Rather than going after the Tokens or George Weiss or somebody that nobody knows. They were like, if we go after Disney, this is going to create some press.
Right.
And so, but they didn't want to sue Disney in the U.S. because that's impossible for them to do, you know? right. financially. So they said, we have to figure out how to sue them in South Africa. So they put a lien on Disney's IP in South Africa. They basically took Mickey Mouse prisoner.
Yeah.
And so Disney had to then go play on their terms.
See,
on
that's
their turf.
Another part I did not really understand was that. So they put a lien on Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck or something.
Yeah.
But I didn't quite understand how they could do that. I guess because they said that Disney had over 250 patents in South Africa.
Trademarks.
Trademarks, rather. Yeah, trademarks. And so they kind of leaned on them, I guess, and said they...
Yeah, well, so they would have had to go to court and say, we think that Disney owes us money for this, and so we're going to put a lien on their intellectual property only for its use in South Africa.
Right.
So it wouldn't have had any bearing on U.S., Europe, none of that. Everything would have been fine. But if they want to use this trademark in South Africa, we're going to get a piece of the action. So Disney would have had to respond to that.
Right.
It was basically just baiting them into responding.
Okay, I get it now.
Yeah.
Okay, I literally rewound and watched that segment a couple times, and I was still a little confused.
Yeah, it wasn't well explained.
Yeah.
It wasn't well explained.
And then so then they bring in this high-powered intellectual property copyright dude who probably gets paid, you know, $400-$600 an hour.
Right.
They bring him in. He finds the obscure Dickens law.
Yeah.
Which is like, I remember he's like, and then I had like an idea. I was taking a
Eureka
shower.
Moment.
Yeah, Eureka moment. I'm like, that, how do you have an Eureka moment around that? And then so they come up with that with the Dickens law, which is like the lifetime of the creator plus 25 years.
Right.
And they put that into use. And then one of the other weird things about this documentary is the second lawyer, the guy we were talking about who didn't really know what he was doing, not the first one, runs into the Minister of Culture in an airport.
Yeah.
And was like, hey, you're the Minister of Culture. Like, this is what we're doing.
Uh-huh.
Can you pay for stuff?
Right.
And they're like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was an important enough song to South Africa that Minister of Arts and Culture went, yeah, I think this is a worthwhile, that song should belong to South Africa. And so it's a worthwhile thing for the government to get involved with to pay for this.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. And they do.
Yeah.
And they get involved and they front some money and they basically, the dude's like, oh, I'm on safari. And me and my wife are on safari and we get a text that says they found in the Supreme Court of South Africa found in their favor.
Mm-hmm.
So Disney was like, fuck, okay.
Yeah.
And then Act 3, which now you think, okay, fucking happy ending. This is awesome.
They even say, it's happy ending, like a Disney movie.
Yeah. It's like, okay, things are going to work out. But no, it doesn't. And that's the weird, I have to say, I'm going to skip a little bit here to the very end, but one of the reasons I really did like this doc, it was not a typical happy ending.
Right.
It really leaves you with like no ending.
Right.
It's really weird.
Yeah.
There's no real ending to this documentary, which is a weird feeling, but it reminds me of the documentaries I loved when I first started getting into docs in the 90s and early 2000s, which were just these like low budget films that really didn't end. It just told the story.
Yep.
And you're just like, fuck.
Yeah.
Okay. So Act 3 is basically, we're like 10 years now after the settlement. And that's the problem is that Disney offered a cash settlement.
Right.
Which is basically was like, if you take the money, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You have no
recourse. They offered them a cash settlement plus future royalties for what would have been the 25 years. So the whole deal expired in 2017.
Uh-huh.
And so now it's done. But yeah, so they did offer them a flat cash plus future royalties.
Right, okay.
In a trust.
Right. Now we're in the trust.
And with the non-disclosure.
Yes. Well, of course. Apparently I thought it was weird that they couldn't, because it was over, they couldn't still disclose. So maybe those NDAs are forever.
Well, I would think the NDA was still in effect while they were shooting it.
Oh, because at the very end, we do find out the money.
Because we're in 2019 right now.
Right.
But, and I think it came out a year and a half ago. So they're shooting it. They're filming it before that NDA is up. So nobody's going to say anything.
Right. Because now we know, because there's a like a black card at the end that basically says what the sisters got.
Right.
Which was around $250,000 each.
Plus the 20% that the one lawyer got. Plus, so you're talking maybe a million, maybe 1.2.
Right.
That they got out of Disney, which Disney made yesterday on Frozen 2. It's a drop in the bucket to Disney. You
Disney
know?
Plus, I mean.
Right, yeah.
Their website crashed.
Right.
In 2019. You don't hear about websites crashing anymore.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, so, I mean, they did what Disney does. Disney will go, nope, we're going to squash that. Okay, well, we weren't able to squash it. Just pay them. Because it's such a small amount of money for us, for Disney, that just pay them, just get them out of our hair, you know? That's the way that Disney tends to deal with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it makes sense.
You know?
Because I thought for sure this was going to end with, like, they got, like, 15 mil.
Uh-huh.
They bought a nice house with a pool. You know, everybody.
And that's what they thought they were going to get.
Right.
You know?
And so they said, okay, this is the crazy, this is infuriating to me, is that they set up a trust. They didn't really ask the sisters what they wanted.
Right.
They basically said, no, you're going to not know how to use this money.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to set up a trust, and we're also going to bring in people we think are going to help you.
Right.
Which was like some dude that was like an accountant or something,
uh-huh.
The lawyer,
yeah.
And some other dude that spoke Zulu,
uh-huh.
So he could interpret and be part of the trust.
Right.
And no, Ryan Milan refused.
Yeah, he didn't want to do it.
Smartly.
Smartly.
This guy is very smart.
Yes.
This Ryan Milan. Wouldn't you like to have some beers and some shots with that guy?
Absolutely.
And
yes.
Just talk music and.
Totally. Yeah.
And so then the sisters are like, no one's ever showed us anything.
Right.
No paperwork. We don't know how much money there is. We don't even know if they've given us all the money we're supposed to have. And then the fucking white ass lawyer dude is like, they're drunks.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're just drinking it away. It's mm-hmm. like, how do you drink away 250 grand?
Right.
That's impossible.
Right.
I've known some serious alcoholics. We're comedians. We know
we
drinkers.
Know. Yes.
Like that seems so fucking shady to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ryan goes and talks. I wish I could remember that lawyer's name. I didn't write it down, unfortunately.
The last guy?
Yeah.
I think I think
well, the
I
guy, the down. Intellectual property guy.
Yeah. What was his name? Owen Dean.
Oh, yeah. Owen Dean.
Owen Dean. Yeah.
He goes and talks to him, and Owen Dean's just like, no, we did everything on the up and up, and they just, you know, and then he's like, couldn't they just be appreciative?
Oh, I know. I was like, really?
You're
going to go there?
Go there, dude.
Yeah.
All the hard work.
Yeah.
Well, you got fucking paid.
Right.
And we're talking about fucking poor ass people
right.
in a shanty town in fucking Johannesburg,
right.
for Christ's sakes.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I mean, when Disney insisted on the trust, I mean, it's a little bit weird of Disney to insist on a trust in the settlement, but I didn't see it as a bad idea because, I mean, when you think about lottery winners and they go, oh, how many lottery winners end up broke a year and a half
90%.
After winning? Yeah, right. So when you take three poor ladies from South Africa who have never had $1 million, there's a good chance they might blow it too. So I don't see the harm in a trust. It was the transparency that they had a problem
Absolutely.
With.
Absolutely. You know? I agree. I think a trust is actually really smart. It's just they had no control over it.
Right.
And they had people telling them what was good for them. And even one of them says they're treating us like kids.
Right.
You know? And it's like, fuck. That's because they already had been treated like kids. And now it's just, they finally got what they wanted. They fought really hard. And now people are just doing it again to them.
Yeah.
You know? And it really sucks. And then there is a follow-up. Ryan Milan gets some paperwork, and he goes through it, and he's like, I don't see any fraud
mm-hmm.
in this, you know. And that's basically it.
Yeah. And it just comes down to he said, she said.
Yeah.
Literally.
There's, like, I'm like, there's got to be bank record. Like, what is going on? It's modern day.
Right.
I can't do anything without a paper trail.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't understand how there's not an equitable paper trail here.
Right.
But apparently there's not.
Yeah.
Nobody's happy.
Uh-huh.
And Ryan's just smoking his, wearing a fucking do-rag and smoking his cigarettes.
Right.
And trying to help out and do the right thing, but.
Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy.
And even he goes, I failed them. And it's like, God, this guy is just so honest.
He's super honest.
Super honest.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, just like, dude, that's your inside voice. What?
Yeah, you know? Right. Yeah, you're on camera. Do you know you're on camera? What would you? What is the theme of this doc to you?
I think the theme is, any sort of artist who's been screwed story in that, you know, the artists get taken advantage of a lot.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think depending on your background, you're going to find different themes in this one, because it could be the, you know, the white people do bad things theme, which is obviously there. It could be the artist gets screwed theme, which is obviously there. I mean, as an artist, that's what I was drawn towards, where I was like, okay, I've seen this story before.
Right.
You know, I've read the Chess Records story. I know how this goes down, you know. It was, you know, one of those two things. And I think it was just, I think the big theme is, you know, this quirky little song that everybody loves so much. Here's the really messed up background of this song.
Right.
You know,
I
love those kind of stories where it's so much deeper than you ever thought it would be.
Yeah.
You know?
Me too. Absolutely. Well, Phil, thank you for bringing this to our attention. I'm glad that we were able to do this today, because it's a really great documentary. It's a great story. It's a really great documentary. The song, you know, but definitely worth the time and to watch it. And it's still streaming on Netflix.
Yep.
So I have a little questionnaire for you that we do with our guests. What's your hometown?
I live in Milpitas, California right now.
That's where you grew up?
I grew up in San Jose, and I literally live 6 blocks across the border now.
Okay,
awesome. I grew up on the edge of San Jose, and now I live on the edge of Milpitas.
Edgy. Yeah. Yeah. Person you are most mistaken for?
Oh, I've gotten Chris Robinson over the years from the Black Crowes. Mm-hmm. There's a good reason I don't play a ukulele on stage, and that's to avoid any Tiny Tim references.
Oh, that is funny. All right. What is your dark secret?
My dark secret? I don't know. I'm so good at not having secrets because I'm very easily guilty.
Right.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. Pet peeve?
Pet peeve is I get really offended at single spaces after a period these days.
Oof.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yikes. Ugh. Jeez. What is your guilty pleasure?
Guilty pleasure. I mean, you know, being a musician, there's probably a lot of music I listen to. The teenage years stuff that does not hold up well anymore.
Like?
Poison, Motley Crue, you know, the 80s hair band stuff that I grew up on. Yeah. Oof,
yeah. What do you never travel without?
I never travel with, most of the time, without my laptop.
Right on. Do you have pets?
No. My girlfriend and I both love dogs, but disagree with how they should be housed. She says they live outside, and I say they live on the bed, and so we don't have a dog.
Kick her out now. Why are you still with her? What is your biggest regret besides dating this girl?
For 26 years, yes, she's my biggest regret. No, my biggest regret would be a financial transaction that I should not have gotten into about 10 years ago.
Oof, isn't that the truth? Okay, who is your celebrity crush?
Celebrity crush. Well, let's see. I hope my girlfriend's not going to listen to this. Big into the gal that plays Daisy on that Marvel TV show, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh,
I can't think of her name.
Yeah. We'll have to put that in the show notes because I don't remember her name either.
I can't. Chloe something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. She is a cutie.
Yes.
She is a cutie. So tell people where they can find you online.
PhilJohnsonComedy.com. Just Google Phil Johnson Comedy and I will come up. Do not just Google Phil Johnson. You get the evangelical philosopher.
That's not you?
That is not me. Okay. And terrible when his people find my website. But yeah, PhilJohnsonComedy.com has links to anything and everything.
You still doing the podcast?
No, I had to give that up because it became very, very time intensive for the amount of money and return I was getting on it. You know?
Yes. I know all too well. Yeah. Yes.
I was spending, you know, 3 days out of my week working on a podcast. It was super fun. It was called